That Money Show with Gabriel Nussbaum on FUBAR Radio.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to That Money Show. I am That Money Guy, aka Gabriel, but mainly go by That Money Guy because it's easier to understand. And I am here to, well, do a lot for you, in particular with the world of money. I mean, it's pretty obvious, That Money Show, we like to talk about money. Our objective is very simple. By the end of this show, we want you to be that little bit better with your finances. It doesn't have to be massive, drastic changes, just that little 1% tweak that will hopefully make you better by the end of this show, and we're going to keep coming back week after week to do the same for you. So, what's going on today? Well, we're going to start off with a little chat about the economy, what's going on, and then I've also got some great guests joining me later. I've got Ola from All Things Money and Beth from Budgets with Beth joining me later on the show. But right now, I'm joined in the studio by Amy Knight, who is a writer at Nerd Wallet. Amy, how are you doing? Welcome to the studio.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
So we've brought you in to help me talk a little bit about what's going on in the news. And I like to say this every single week. We like to speak about relevant and specific news, the stuff that actually affects people's pockets, because a lot of the time there's so many different headlines that it gets overwhelming. So let's break down the key ones that actually affect people. Last week, we had a few big announcements. First up was inflation rates. Down to 2%, which is the target, finally.
Yep, woo-hoo. Celebration.
Ish. half a woohoo. I mean, it's kind of like, yay, but also like, what does this actually mean? And at the same time, things are still getting more expensive. And the other big announcement, unsurprisingly, was the Bank of England holding interest rates. Again, 5.25%. Didn't cause any stirs, no shocks in the system this time. So what are your thoughts about them holding in the first place? Are you surprised, or are you as like everyone else, or like me in particular, more of the same? When's it going to drop? This kind of seems like we're stuck here forever.
Everybody's definitely feeling a bit jaded by the whole interest rate dialogue. I wasn't surprised because literally nobody was predicting a rate cut in June, but that's not what it looked like a few weeks ago. 20th of June, which was the last MPC meeting, that's the Monetary Policy Committee, happened to be my birthday, so I was really hoping we were going to get good news. But the Monetary Policy Committee, so this is part of the Bank of England, they are separate from government. So I think the first thing that's important for people to understand is that although there's rumours flying around about the election, the decision to keep the base rate the same was nothing to do with politics. It's very separate, and the Bank of England are trying to keep the economy stable, and they're doing that by looking at years worth of data. So we're obsessing about month by month data releases, maybe what's happened over a quarter. They are literally looking at the history of the British economy when they're trying to predict the twists and turns of what interest rates and growth in wages and things like that are going to do. So that's quite separate. It has still been frustrating and disappointing for people who had hoped that rates would start coming down in June, particularly for first-time buyers who have spent months, if not years, watching and waiting for the borrowing situation to improve.
Right over here.
And what I would say to those listeners is actually the most important thing is your own budget, your own personal financial situation, because buying a house is one of, if not the biggest financial commitments you're ever going to make. It's a long-term decision, and it's more about how much time you're going to spend in the market as against timing the market.
Yeah, classic. I've heard that with a lot of things in personal finance. That kind of rings a bell when you talk about investing as well in general. But I feel like if you cast your kind of memory back to the beginning of 2024, I mean, how many interest rate drops were the markets factoring in? Was it three or four?
We were very optimistic back then.
I think at one point, someone was predicting that interest rates were going to be below 4% by the end of 2024 or the start of 2025. Okay, that's off the table now. We'll be lucky if we get one, maybe two in by the end of the year as a bit of a prediction. I mean, I think that the kind of consensus is that the likelihood is we might have a good chance in August. So that's the next announcement coming up in 6 weeks.
Yeah.
We might start to look at a 5% or a 0.25% drop. Is this something that you're calculating as well?
I wouldn't say calculating.
Hoping, but praying for.
Definitely hoping.
Yeah.
And I think it's I don't know about probable, but it's definitely possible we could see another rate cut later on in the year if the services inflation starts to cool down. That's the main reason why the Bank of England have had to hold rates where they are, because although we've seen food prices, the inflation on food has cooled down. That means it's rising less quickly. And even some food products have actually dropped in price. Energy, we're not sure what's going to happen around the corner, but right now, energy prices are
also
not
dropping.
Not too frightening.
Yeah.
But the services sector, this is where companies rely on staff that they have to pay wages to, and wages are growing.
They are.
And that inflation is what people have been talking about as sticky and why they have not been able to bring it down. So if in August, when the Bank of England Monetary Policy Committee meet again, if that services inflation is starting to slow down, we could be more optimistic of a following rate cut.
Yeah. So just to kind of fill in anyone listening, the Bank of England don't just see that 2% headline, which is CPI. They're not just looking at this one basket of goods. They look at a number of different types of inflation, one which you were talking about, the services level of inflation, which looks at, you know, general wages of different sectors. That's not cooling down. There's also core inflation, which is, you know, the core things that we're buying. That's also not as low at 2% right now as well. And they have to factor all this in. So having seen the data, the latest announcements in terms of inflation, do you think the Bank of England are doing the right thing, staying cautious at the moment and not making these rash decisions?
The last thing they want to do is trigger another inflationary spike. We've made so much progress. It's been a very slow, painful journey to get where we are. We've had to suffer with these high interest rates. As soon as we start making progress, we don't want to reverse that. So that's where the caution comes in.
Yeah. And they were so slow to react the first time round when the shit was hitting the fan, like 3 or 4 years ago, the Bank of England were very slow to react. So here I feel like they're being extra cautious. Like, we're not going to just change things because it's going to help, you know, someone over the next 3 months. They're looking at the next 3 to 5 to 10 years to make sure scenarios like this really don't affect our economy again, which you have to think is a good thing. But obviously, when you look at the individual, like you mentioned, people like first time buyers or people coming off of mortgages, they're the ones suffering as a result of this,
yeah.
Which is really unfortunate. But I remember someone was telling me, if you go back literally 20 years ago, rates of 5% were unheard of. People thought that they were doing really well in the mortgage market when you were getting 5% interest rate.
Yeah.
It's just this, like, what's it called? Recency bias.
Absolutely.
That we have this idea that we deserve 1% mortgage rate. I feel like, and it's a good thing, I think, that we are now aware, with hindsight, that those periods are long gone. If they ever do come back, grab them with two hands if those are the opportunities you have. But yeah, that was a period of, you know, historical importance and significance, but also uniqueness, rather than the historical norm that we should expect. I mean, I assume you have that kind of same.
It really depends what you've grown up with, what your context is, what feels expensive to one person feels manageable to somebody else. So it is very much down, like everything with money, to your personal circumstances.
Yeah. And the thing you were speaking about earlier about first-time buyers, who are looking at this number, shaking their head again. You were speaking about it should be more about your affordability. Ignore the actual scenarios that are going on in the market. So if you are a first-time buyer, you know, you've built your deposit and you're just waiting and you're waiting. You're like, oh, maybe it'll be August. What would your advice be to someone in that position?
It's definitely important to have an awareness of what the market is doing. But the price of houses is likely to go up when the interest rates start falling down. So interest rates make mortgages more affordable when they come down. So more first-time buyers will flood into the market. And when that demand increases, the price of houses is likely to go up. So what you might save by holding out for a slightly cheaper mortgage deal, you're going to lose out by paying for a more expensive house.
Yeah, it's the classic one. It's a lot of people are always asking, when's the right time to buy? The right time to buy is when you can afford to buy it.
100% agree.
You've kind of built your kind of expectation, costs, it's, you know, within your budget, all that kind of stuff. Yeah. But overall, it's when you can afford to pay that monthly mortgage and that price.
And when you've stress tested yourself, so your mortgage lender will do a stress test to see what you can afford, and they will factor in interest rate fluctuations, stress test yourself as well, and figure out what you're comfortable with. You can use a calculator, mortgage repayment calculator, on a website like NerdWallet UK, and you can just see what would happen to your monthly repayment if the interest rate spiked up again.
Cool, brilliant. A second quick story that I would love to discuss with you is an interesting kind of headline, which said that about 30% of adults in this country have no idea how much they need to retire with. Again, I feel like I do fall into that category. I might be the one in three, but I'm also 26, so I haven't even looked to start calculating that amount. Does that shock you in any way, shape or form? But I think that one thing that might shock you, because you've shook your head at me there saying it doesn't shock you, is that 21% of those of people above the age of 50 have no idea. And those are the people that you really thought would kind of, you know, have their eggs in their basket, you know, everything lined up, knowing what's coming around the corner. One in five people above 50 not knowing how much they need to retire. That's a bit scary.
It is scary. It's worrying, but it's also very understandable. I think there's a lot of things we could unpack in this. And you mentioned, when we're talking about interest rates, the recency bias. So in psychological terms, we feel like right now is the most important thing. It's difficult to prioritize something that's decades in the future. Mm-hmm. We don't like thinking or talking about getting old. It's very difficult to put your future needs above your wants right now. And so it is understandable why people have put off tackling the pension problem for themselves. Thankfully, when the automatic enrollment came into effect,
the greatest thing that's ever happened to this country,
it has worked like a charm, because so many more people now have some form of pension provision. But we need to be doing more. We need to be actively engaging with our pensions as early as possible. And younger people who may have a little bit more disposable income, particularly if they don't have dependents yet, mm-hmm. if you're able to increase your pension contribution by just a couple of percent, even better if your employer will match that extra contribution, it is so worthwhile and your future self will thank you.
Yeah. And I know people are going to sit here thinking like, boring pensions, like it's so far away. But it's actually a little bit scary, the drastic changes you can make to that future version of yourself by just tweaking little things here or there. I know we spoke about pension enrollment, and that is incredible, because I think the statistics have shown that so many more people are now paying into their pension thanks to the fact you're automatically put into it and you have to opt out rather than having to opt in, where you know automatically being paid that into your salary, which I think is a brilliant thing. But a lot of people don't know how much they should even be contributing towards their pension. Are there any kind of standard formulas that someone can take right now and apply that to the way they're paying into their pension?
There's a couple of starting points. So 8%, I think, is the most typical pension contribution. That's usually made up of 5% of your salary going in and then a 3% contribution from your employer. If you can aim to get that up to 12% by contributing extra, and that doesn't necessarily mean that you have to lose money out of your paycheck every month. You could make a lump sum. If you know that your grandpa gives you a few £100 every Christmas, you can allocate that and chuck it in your pension. And then the other thing to consider is that, as a rule of thumb, you can retire comfortably on around 2/3 of what you're earning when you retire. And for younger people, hopefully their salary is going to go up quite a lot. If you, again, go back to your budget and look at, right, what are the kind of outgoings I'm not going to have when I'm not working anymore? If you drive to work, the costs for your car, the fuel, the tyres, take those things out of the equation. You can see how, okay, yeah, 2/3 of what I'm living on now might see me through when I'm retired. So again, I would encourage people to go online and play around with online calculators. If you've got a pension, well done you. Go and log on to the platform and see what happens when you dial that percentage contribution up a few notches and see what happens also with your retirement age. I think it's really important that we have conversations now about the reality of people needing to work much later in life and continuing to contribute to their pension into their older years.
Yeah, and I always like to tell people that pension match scheme. So if you are employed, this idea that your employer will match, if you put in 5%, they will put in 3%. A lot of companies actually opt to do more than that. They'll match you sometimes 5 and 5, sometimes 7 and 7. Like, your company might be really generous and go 10 and 10. I know that, for example, if you work in the government, they have an incredible pension scheme, as well as some other areas of kind of the public service. It's important to note that if you don't take advantage of that every single month, that money is lost. So if you don't match it 1 month, you can't really go back and retrospectively get that money in most cases. And so it's kind of a use it or lose it scheme. And remember, this is extra free money that your government are throwing at a future, at your employer, are throwing at a version of yourself. So it's really important to make sure you're aware of what the scheme is that your company offer.
Yeah.
And be really sure that you need that money, not in your pension, before you start to opt out of it. Mm-hmm. Because like we said, these are the things that are going to, you know, make 60, 70, 80-year-old version of yourself think, you know, bloody hell, I did things right. Thank God for 25-year-old me. Rather than sitting at 60, 70 thinking, can't retire now because I have to continue working because I can't support the lifestyle that I need, or even like a minimal lifestyle.
Yeah, particularly if you've taken out a 35-year mortgage and you're still paying it at age 70.
Yeah.
The one other thing that I would add on with your pension, if you have debts that you need to pay off, it's probably a good idea to clear those before you start trying to save loads more into your pension, because once you've put it in your pension, you cannot get it out again, even if you really, really need it until your retirement age.
Great caveat and a great little like tip to last right at the end. I always say to the listeners, you're going to get a little bit of like nuggets of wisdom here or there. That was one specifically on the point. Amy, thank you so much for joining me here in the studio. I know that I said that was one nugget of wisdom. There were many nuggets of wisdom across those 15 minutes. So I really appreciate you coming in to join us today.
Thank you.
Amazing. Anyway, that brings us to the end of our first section. And remember to stick around, because straight after this, I'm joined by Ola from All Things Money in the studio. We'll see you then.
That Money Show on FUBAR Radio with Gabriel Nussbaum.
FUBAR Radio presents
That Money Show with Gabriel Nussbaum.
Joining me now, I have Claire Seal, who is a content creator and author.
You know, I think there's loads of shame when it comes to money and financial difficulty, but I honestly think that that shame is really a symptom of the judgment that exists in society. I don't think that people are feeling ashamed for the sake of it. I think they're feeling ashamed because you can't really sort of open your phone or open a newspaper without seeing these huge judgments piled on people who've made mistakes with money. And I think it's acceptable for people to slag you off about being bad with money in a way that it might not be for like other mistakes that you might make.
Politics Uncensored with Ali Milani.
Let's bring in Tobias Elwood, former defence minister.
Rishi Sunak has done well to pivot us back, taken us into far calmer political waters.
Has he taken you back into calmer political waters? I mean, you're on track, according to some of the polls, to the largest wipeout in years, and, you know, may never return from it. I mean, how has he taken you back into calmer political waters?
We've just seen inflation go down to 2%. Confidence in business is returning.
But is that down to Rishi Sunak?
You've got to let me finish the question. You keep asking me a question and then throwing another question in.
I'm just curious to know, is inflation down to Rishi Sunak?
What the health with Gabby Allen.
I have this stunning Steph Williams with me now, founder of the We Glow app. I did turf games on Sunday.
Oh yeah.
And it was horrible. It was horrible. But it was so fun. But it was like savage, right? Yeah. But I wasn't the best in the room and I hate that. And I was like, oh God, I haven't trained like well enough for this. Yeah.
Yeah.
But like I don't normally think I am, but then when I was there, I was like, this is so annoying because and then I was like, why do I actually need to be good at this though? Yeah. Like, can I not just do it for fun?
But also it's like when I've done like casts and stuff before and the blokes were like, lift that heavier weight, and I'm like, no, like I'm good.
Yeah.
I don't need to lift the heavier weight. Like I know what I'm capable of, I know what works for my body.
Yeah.
And I think it's just kind of like, I know what makes me feel good.
Yeah.
And ultimately if you're working out to feel good, you're gonna look good.
You're listening to FUBAR Radio.
FUBAR Radio.
FUBAR Radio.
FUBAR Radio.
FUBAR Radio.
Hello and welcome back to That Money Show. As a quick reminder, this is That Money Show. I am That Money Guy and we are live on FUBAR Radio. And joining me now in the studio is Ola, founder of All Things Money and a really good friend, actually, as well. Welcome to the studio. It's great to finally have you in here.
Thank you for having me. It took a while to get me on here, but I'm very excited to be here with you.
Yeah, did I finally convince you to come into the studio on the one day that it's like 26 degrees outside? Yeah. So thanks for agreeing that. I got my shorts on, not that you can see it. They're below the table, but summer has finally hit the UK, which normally means like joy, smile, no money problems, no money worries, maybe slightly the opposite. but yeah, let's kind of go back to the start, because you've been doing all things money for 3 years, 4 years?
4 years, over 4 years now.
4 years. I mean, talk me through the kind of like inception of all things money. Where did it even come from?
Oh, good question. So I graduated back in 2020 during a fun time called the pandemic. Don't know if you remember it.
Yep.
But I had plans to travel to Australia once I'd finished. And obviously, thanks to COVID, I couldn't go anywhere. So I taught myself how to invest the little money I had left over, because I wasn't paying rent, because obviously I was living at home. And that same week, I got my friends investing. And I was like, oh my gosh, if I can get my friends investing, I want to teach every young adult across the UK how to manage their finances and invest. So yeah, started All Things Money on Instagram originally, and yeah, now it's my full-time job, which is wild.
That's mad. So it's gone from started to invest and teach myself about it, to teaching my friends about it, to posting about it online, to it being your full-time career.
Yeah.
I mean, I guess 4 years is quite a long period of time when you come to think of it. What's kind of been the biggest difference maker, the thing that you have seen people kind of like grasp onto the most when it comes to you teaching about money?
I think it's the idea about making your money work harder for you, because I think all of us work so hard for our money, right? And I think the UK have become great savers, but when we're earning just 5% interest rates, sometimes you think, could my money be doing more than that? So I really like the idea of being able to teach people how to invest in the stock market, but also find other ways of creating income as well, because I feel like it's, you can't just rely on one income anymore. So teaching those ideas is really important to me.
Yeah, I think that's completely vital. I mean, so many people are always asking, especially like young people, like, how do I make more money?
Yes.
How do I get into this? How do I get into that? And they often seem to like try a million and one things, and none of them ever stick down for them. But I think it's really important, like you said, with the money that you do end up having, it's just as important to make that work. So obviously all these side hustles are great, you know, all these schemes to do X, Y, and Z, but actually managing it well is just as important, because imagine like you bring it all in and it's gone the next month. I feel like this is the biggest problem that we're seeing with, especially like our generation, who, I don't know, it feels like our generation are kind of both incredibly wise, but incredibly careless at the same time. Like, they're probably more financially aware than many generations before them. They understand the value. They understand things like investing has become accessible to the masses. You know, saving rates. There's so many competitive saving rates pushing it down. Finance seems to be in the news every other second. They've got social media where we're kind of shouting down their throats, like do better with your money and stuff like that. But at the same time, they're feeling, you know, hard done by. It's impossible to kind of get anywhere with your money in life. Not earning enough. Things are so expensive. Life is so expensive. And we can't do half as much with our money as our parents used to be able to do it. Are you seeing that kind of same attitude and response? And like, kind of, what do you say to the people like that?
Good question. I think careless of things is a harsh response. I think the economy hasn't helped a lot of us young people. Like, there's so many of us that are actively saving. So many of us want to get on the property ladder. But society at the moment and the economy, the state it's in, hasn't made it easy for us young adults to be able to get where we want to in life. And you know, it's very easy to be like, oh, you know, all of us are spending all our money on like coffees and avocados, but really we haven't seen salaries increase for a number of years. So that's the main issue, not people being reckless with their money. So I think there's loads of things that have kind of, you know, hindered us to get to where we want to. So yeah, I think it's more than just our attitudes to money now. I just think society is quite tough.
I was probably a bit harsh with careless there, because I mean, like, I can be careless with my money as well, for sure. But what I think I mean by that, I mean, like, the older generations, I mean, everyone's seen that viral clip where the person was like, if the younger generations just stop buying avocados every single week, they'll be able to buy a house. Like, no offense, shut up, mate. Like,
literally.
We're eating the avocados because that's the only thing that can make us happy right now, because we have no chance of being able to afford the house. That's kind of the response that I say. And I think that when I say careless, I mean, there are still things that are careless. I'm careless sometimes with my money. But I mean, a lot of that just stems down to, I just don't know what to do with it. Like, I've got this cash, like, I can either spend it, I can stick it away in my current account or my savings account. But aside from that, like, I may as well just go out and spend it, because I've had no education in school, I've had no education in university, I've had no kind of formal conversations with my family. My parents were rubbish with money, my siblings are rubbish with money. So like, where do you go? I don't want to talk to my friends about my salary because maybe they're earning way more than me. And yeah. I don't like, it's an uncomfortable conversation. Mm. We're British. We hate opening up in these kind of things. So like, are you seeing a change in that through the way that you're opening up to your community and hopefully allowing them to open up to their communities?
Yeah, I think so. I think money, sadly, will always be a bit of like a taboo in the UK. But I think,
wish it wasn't.
Yeah, same. But I think slowly but surely, I think attitudes are slowly changing, especially with the younger generation. I think what I love about my community is when we get together in person and you actually see all of us who originally would never speak about, I don't know, money at the pub or like over a drink, are all coming together and speaking about money in real life. Everyone realises they're either in similar situations or they're actually discovering things they didn't know because someone else was able to bring it up to their attention as well. Because I feel like with money, you don't know what you don't know. So I think we're so hard on ourselves, but it's like, we don't know what we don't know, basically. So I think what I love about the community is when we actually get together in person or online when we're doing like my workshops and things, and we actually just foster that safe space for people to speak about. I don't think we realise the power of being able to do that.
I picked up on one thing you said there, which is like, honestly makes my heart so warm, which is the idea of learning from other people. And we don't know what we don't know.
Yeah.
So everyone always asks me, like, why do you talk about money so openly? And why do you want to break this taboo? Like, it's personal finance. Like, the first word is personal. Mm-hmm. Make it personal. And I'm like, if you're not taught about it, you have to hear what other people are doing to succeed or fail.
Yeah.
If I say to you, I've just opened the best savings account, it's got 5.something%. And then you're sitting there going, I think mine's only got like 3. Voila, straight away, I've literally almost doubled. My math isn't quite great there, but you know.
Nearly doubled.
Yeah, nearly doubled your interest rate on your savings account. The same way that you start to tell your friends about how to invest. And now all of a sudden they know about the benefits of investing. That is why these conversations are vital. Even if you're listening into this one right now, hopefully we're kind of like sprinkling in something for you to take away and learn a little bit more about. Speaking about successes and failures then, have you had any failures with your money? I mean, we can stretch it back all the way to, you know, your childhood, university, buying that thing that you maybe shouldn't have bought, being a bit careless here or there. Any things that you regret financially?
There's two. One is, I always say this, I wish I started investing from a younger age. But again, you don't know what you don't know, right? So I'm always hounding my 18-year-old sister now to just open up her stocks and shares ISA. Because if I started investing at 18 rather than 22, that would have been an extra 4 years in the stock market. Because like Amy said earlier, it's time in the market rather than time in the market, right? So that's one thing. And I guess it's not a real regret. We need to give ourselves grace, right? But another thing is, I think it was like a couple of years ago now, I spent money on a designer handbag and literally that designer got cancelled maybe like a week or two after. So it's in my house and I've never worn it out.
That's really sad. But that could be like a unique masterpiece, right? That is one of a kind. They don't make it anymore. So you can
No, they still make it. But I just don't. Maybe the time of cancellation is probably past now. But at that time, I remember what I just bought it. I said to my sister, I was like, can I wear this out? She's like, Ola, if I were you. No.
Oh, cancelled in that kind of way.
Yeah.
Got it. Cancelled. Ah, understood. Can you sell it? Maybe? I don't know.
it's clearly not my world. It's gathering dust at the moment, but maybe one day.
maybe one day. All right. Moving swiftly onwards. Something really interesting that I saw you did recently was you headed to Downing Street.
Yes.
With Go Henry, I believe.
Yes.
As part of a campaign to bring education to young children when it comes to finances. I mean, again, we're talking about someone that started this entire education platform 4 years ago to standing outside of Downing Street to hand over a petition. How did that feel and how does that resonate with you?
Oh, to be fair, I don't do a good enough job of reflecting back on things I've done. But when you say it like that, you do think, gosh, that is actually a really big achievement.
Yeah, it's incredible.
For sure. Thank you. So, like it was a wild moment. Like I remember texting my auntie on the way back being like, just letting you know, your niece has just been at 10 Downing Street. She's like, is there anything you're not doing at the moment? And I was like, good question. But no, I think the biggest thing for that is the fact that a lot of because I talk about education and the importance of financial education in school on LinkedIn. That's my bread and butter and what I rant about all the time. So it was nice to see the recognition of like my passion for these changes to be, you know, manifested in a way where I get to go to 10 Downing Street. And I think that was what mattered to me, that the fact that my voice is being heard and other people are noticing that is something that's really important to me. And is there any way I can get involved in these kind of petitions and campaigns? So I really, really appreciated being invited by Go Henry.
Yeah, for sure. And if you are out there trying to voice a petition to make, you know, finances better, like lean on us as creators, like people within the education space, especially in the financial education space, that are trying to shout and push. You know, we have audiences. Mm. We have people that are listening to us. These are the exact things that I think we built our platforms in the first place for. So I'm so happy that GoHenry did that with you, and they hopefully will do many, many more things, and that petition will actually go through and make a difference.
Yeah, hopefully.
But I mean, thinking again, linking to 10 Downing Street, elections around the corner, what do you want to see from a future government? I mean, maybe if you could like sprinkle in one, two or three things that you would love to change about the way either education's done in our country or specifically how finances are managed in this country.
Yeah, one, two or three ways, Gabriel?
Yeah, okay, just one, two or three. You pick.
Firstly, I think they need to... Right, I think it's really hard because it's really easy to say that they need to push financial education in all schools, right? Yes, it's on the curriculum, but it's actually not compulsory for all schools to teach financial literacy. So I think it's really hard to put pressure on these schools where a lot of these teachers don't even have the education themselves, right? So I am a trustee of a financial education charity, My Bank, who actually do an amazing job of going into schools to deliver this this education. So I think government, if they can't fund the teaching themselves, I think they need to be doing a better job of partnering with charities for them to then do the delivery. I think that's really important. Two, I think they need to do a better job of actually encouraging the conversation in schools around, like, with children as well. I think it's really important that, yes, we have, you know, the education and we have that all sorted, but I think we need to change the... I think the idea of what money looks like and how it's taught in schools as well, because I think, you know, we all saw Rishi Sunak wanted to teach maths until A-levels, right? Well, that's not going to help the person that's finishing school at 16 and doesn't, what is on like minimum wage and doesn't know how to manage their finances. So I think they need to do a better job of actually teaching money in schools in a way that is relevant to outside life. Like, you know, we all did trigonometry, you all know percentage and how that works, but I think it's really important that we actually apply those principles.
We all know that Sally wants to buy 16 watermelons for a summer party. How much do they cost?
We need to apply those principles to real life situations. I think that's really important as well.
I think those are perfect. So anyone, any MP listening right now, I mean, we've just made it so easy for you. That is all you have to do. And one thing that I like that you said about younger children is the fact that I think there was a recent study that said children as young as 7, that's when their financial attitude is set. Mm-hmm. So it's not just for 15 to 18-year-olds. Like, we need to be doing this right the way through, which is really vital. One last question that I think is, like, my favourite question to ask anyone. What one piece of financial advice would you be telling to a younger version of you? Because there are going to be many listening to this. And they want to know that one thing that will save them and make them millions. No, I'm joking.
So, yeah, I kind of answered it earlier. I think my biggest one would be to invest in the stock market. Obviously, it's not financial advice, and obviously you have to do your research and all those disclaimers. But I think, you know, it's about making your money work harder for you, right? Like I said, interest rates are at 5%. But if you're investing in, I don't know, a fund or an ETF, I'm not going to make it complicated. But if you started investing in something like that from the age of 18 right up until you're like 60, 65, mate, you're going to be laughing.
Yeah. I like that. Mate, you are going to be laughing. Yeah. Put that on a t-shirt.
Literally.
Absolutely.
All things money merch.
I love what a great way to end it. Thank you so much for coming in. I feel like if anyone can just listen to that last piece right there, that is an absolute gem. But if they listen to the entire interview, then they're probably sorted themselves for life. But yeah, thank you. It's great to finally have you on the show.
Thank you for having me.
Absolute pleasure. Anyway, that leads us on to Money Tip of the Week, which is another great little part where I like to share with you a quick 1 or 2 minute thing to do every single week that can help you get better with money. I'm going to lean on what Ola just said right there. Investing, you heard her, stocks and shares, ISA. If you've never opened one before, find any platform. I genuinely don't care which platform. You can kind of tweak and perfect that at a later stage, but just put £1 away. £1. Start getting the feel of what investing is. Signing up to the platform, looking at all the different options, the different funds, the different markets, the different ETFs, you know, the different individual stocks, and pick one and put £1. You're never going to miss £1. That will go like that in your normal daily life, right? Put it away. Just see what happens with it. And then start to teach yourself how to invest off the back of that. Why do I say just £1? Because I think that by putting skin in the game, that is actually how you start to get used to the feeling. And it's probably going to be the biggest motivator to actually get you start investing. And according to Ola, and not just Ola, according to myself as well, investing is one of the best ways to make your money work hard for you. That's all for now. Anyway, coming up after this short break, I've got Beth Tideman, the founder of Budgets with Beth. So make sure to stick around and we'll see you then.
Making personal finance simpler with Gabriel Nussbaum. This is That Money Show.
FUBAR Radio presents What the
Health with Gabby Allen. Joining me now is Millie Gooch, author and founder of Sober Girl Sobriety Society. I need to know what is so bad about dating sober.
I think it's just terrifying when it's something that you're not used to, because when I was drinking and dating, you know, like, you use it to calm your nerves, you use it for confidence, you rely on it. And I think that's the one thing I realised when I stopped drinking, is how much I really relied on alcohol. I was always kind of saying, you know, like, oh, I'm not dependent on it, but for my confidence I was really. But I also think there's so many benefits to it. Like, I used to go on so many dates when I was drinking, I'd be like, they are the one, and then I'd meet them a few weeks later sober and I'd be like, we've got nothing in common, what was going through my mind? I'd be like, oh, it was because I was drunk.
Access all areas with Bobby Norris.
Harpreet, how are you, my love?
I'm great, thank you. How are you? It looks fun in there.
I want to talk about this because obviously you met your partner on The Apprentice. When did you start to get that feeling, I'm into him and this is more than just a banter or a friendship? Because it's a close environment being on a show like that, isn't it?
I really wish I could sit here and give loads of juicy gossip that actually we used to secretly meet in the laundry room on the show, but we didn't. And when I actually last spoke with yourselves, I think it was right after I'd won, we weren't even flirting, never mind dating. First time that I thought I actually fancied him was when I watched him on TV and I watched episode one. Hang on. You know, he's actually really good looking.
Politics Uncensored with Ali Milani.
And joining me in the studio, we have Deputy Leader of the Green Party, Zach Polanski. Zach, thank you so much for joining us. How are you keeping, Zach?
I'm great. Thanks for having me. How are you?
So you're hoping for four MPs in the general. You think that's going to happen?
Yeah, that's absolutely the minimum at what we're
I don't want to be Piers Morgan here, but will you take out, I don't have £1,000, will you take a £100 bet with me that you'll get four MPs?
Well, I do everything in politics to talk about the harms of gambling. So for me to very place good. A bet on there would be pretty,
you know,
pretty horrendous.
Before we had you on, we discussed with the producers as to whether I should do the bet joke, and I said I would because I had every faith that you would answer it in the way I expect a politician of any moral standing.
We should also talk about cryptocurrency, which also is very problematic.
Rishi, if you're listening, mate, that's how you answer a betting question.
You're listening to FUBAR Radio.
FUBAR Radio.
FUBAR Radio.
FUBAR Radio.
FUBAR Radio.
Hello and welcome back to That Money Show. For those of you that have literally just tuned in, I am That Money Guy. I also go by Gabriel, but on the show I go by That Money Guy. This is That Money Show. And our objective here is to make you better with your money. Simple as, full stop. Anyway, I've got Beth Tideman, the founder of Budgets with Beth, with me in the studio. Welcome.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Yeah, it's great to have you away from school, I just learned recently. I hope none of your students are watching or listening to this. I hope they're in school. Yep, just leaving school. Anyway, I'd love to hear a little bit about kind of your overview of how you created Budgets with Beth in the first place, because I've seen it and it's great, but I want to know where it came from.
Yes, well, 18 months ago, I was living paycheck to paycheck. Every month, money would come into my account. I would put my bill money away. It would get paid. I'd put a little bit into savings and then I'd spend. And within a week or so, I would get a notification to say you're in your overdraft. And I think, how has that happened? I'd pull some savings back out, think we're okay. A few days later, back in my overdraft, pull my savings back out. And I got to the point where I was even making the smallest purchases on my credit card, going out for a coffee, £3 on my credit card because I didn't have the money in my bank account. And I came across cash stuffing on TikTok. I found some people doing it and I'd never seen it happen in the UK before. I'd seen it in America and I'd seen other countries doing it, and I thought, I'm going to give this a go. And 18 months ago I started, I withdrew my first month's wages, and I'm here and I've been doing it ever since, and I do not regret it one little bit.
I mean, it sounds like you've made incredible changes. So that version of yourself living paycheck to paycheck, let's fast forward 18 months today. Yeah. How are you with money?
So much better. I have a real grasp on what money really means, where I want to spend my money, where I don't want my money to go. Just knowing those sensible choices around spending, knowing how to save properly, and just having a real visual method of saving money has given me such freedom.
And you spoke specifically about that method, which is called cash stuffing.
Cash stuffing.
Cash stuffing. I mean, I think to describe it for what it is quite literally withdrawing your cash and stuffing it into different folders for different things.
Exactly.
To make sure that, I suppose, it makes it more visual. It's hands-on, tangible. So therefore, it's not just a card that's tapping, 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 tapping away. by actually doing this, you get that control because it's within your hands. Yes. So once it's gone, that envelope is empty, yep, right?
And you can't carry on spending.
Yeah. So that was my definition of cash stuffing. You've clearly been doing it for a very long time. Could you explain to someone that's never heard it? Maybe yeah. they've seen it online a little bit here or there, but exactly what it is and how it works. Yeah.
So it's a budgeting method, which is only using cash. So you withdraw your cash. You then divide it between your sort of weekly expenses, food, shop, petrol, personal spending. Then any money that's left over, you put towards what we call sinking funds. So they are the funds that you want to save towards. Might be birthdays, Christmas, holidays. And you would allocate a certain amount to those and you would pop it into an envelope and you would build those funds up slowly so that when you get to a point like Christmas, you have the money already there. You're not having to put it on your credit card or put it from anywhere else. It's about having that money in advance of needing to spend it.
So how does anyone get started with this? Because I assume it's not as simple as literally like pulling out a folder, withdrawing your monthly salary yeah. for that month and doing it. Because it's, I mean, like I'm trying to think this when I started budgeting, because there's obviously various routes. Yeah. This is one route. It was really hard because you don't really know what you even spent on yes. the previous month. So how yeah. do you go about getting it to a stage where it's like actually consistently working yeah. for you?
So in my first month of cash stuffing, I printed off my bank statements and I went through with different coloured highlighters and I worked out what money was going on food, what money was going on spending, what money was going on bills. And I worked out where I was overspending, where I needed to spend. So I worked out how much do I actually need to spend on food shopping for a family of four to get through a month. And then I created a budget based on that. So I accounted for all of my bills. They were all worked out. Then I worked out my weekly spends, how much for food, how much for petrol, how much for personal spending. Then from there, whatever was left over, as I work on a zero-based budget, so there's nothing left in the account, I worked out how much do I want to put towards things. Is there a goal like Christmas where I need a certain amount, divided that by the amount of months I might have until that, and then I would say, here's £40 a month going into Christmas, or here's £20 going towards my car fund. And I just worked out my budget based on my needs that I wanted to save towards. And this will vary for different people. Everyone has different amounts they want to save. But I just took the time to go through my spending from the month before and really work out what is unnecessary and what I do want to save towards.
So, I mean, speaking with like my specific like mathematical hat on,
yeah.
obviously there's a lot of incentives towards saving your money digitally yeah. because you get interest rates from the yeah. banks and various things like that. So if someone's asking you like, why would I go with this method yeah. where I can't get any kind of benefit
yeah.
from a good savings rate, mm-hmm. all that kind of stuff, what's your response to them?
Yeah, so I would say that I personally have saved far more using this method because I'm not just tapping my card away. If you're somebody who really struggles with tapping your card multiple times a day on things you don't need, actually taking it back to cash, you will find that you are saving more money. Also, as I fill my challenges up, so if I'm setting aside £300 for a girls' weekend, once I've got to that target, I do pay it then into my bank account and it sits in a pot. And usually that does then gain the interest. It might not have gained it while I'm building it up, but once it's in there, it is. So there are ways of making sure you're gaining that interest. But for me, as someone who overspent and didn't have any money, I actually now in cash have more money than I would have in a savings pot.
So it's a pretty easy argument, right? You're literally saying to someone, well, if the alternative, you're telling me that there's a great interest rate there, yeah. but if you're not actually going to save it, then yeah. obviously I'm winning. I'd rather have this without the interest rate yeah. benefit than not have it
yeah.
at all in the first place. I mean, that makes obviously complete sense. What's the kind of line that you draw between this is withdrawable money that goes into a folder versus this is actually quite a large bulk of my savings yeah. that should stay in a savings account? So I know you said about building it up, but yeah. are there any kind of long-term pots that you wouldn't really ever withdraw?
Yeah, so currently saving for a house deposit and I wouldn't withdraw that money.
That'd be a lot of cash.
Yes, it yeah. would. So that goes automatically straight into a high interest saving account
yeah.
because I know that there's a goal for that money. It's got a purpose and I won't withdraw it. I often have funds and I'll probably work about £200 in a fund at a time before I then pay it in. So I might have 10 funds on the go at £200 and then pay it into the bank so that money's not sat in my house, but knowing that my home insurance covers a certain amount, so I make sure I'm less than the amount that my home insurance covers, and just what I feel safe with having at home.
Yeah, safety's probably
yeah, it's key.
A big one as well. If you're really into cash stuffing and all that kind of stuff,
yeah,
you might not want to have just cash lying around your house. Maybe buy yourself a folder with a padlock,
yes, or a safe.
A folder with a padlock, aka a safe. I love that. I've just completely been done then. Well, one thing that I think would be a really interesting conversation as well is the idea of moving towards a cashless society.
Yeah.
I think the latest study said was compared to 5 years ago, I think we have a third less cash within our kind of society. So yeah. I believe it was about 300 million being withdrawn every single day to now 200 million being withdrawn. Yeah. That sounds like a lot, so I hope I got the statistics right. But I think percentage-wise, it's the same. So, I mean, again, with your method and kind of moving towards this idea that some shops don't even take cash anymore, how are you kind of finding that balance? Has it hindered you in any way?
Yeah, I have found that most shops are willing to take cash. The ones that won't take cash, I will use cards, so I leave a little bit on my in my bank account to cover that. And often places like restaurants, you can find out in advance if they do take cash. I do think that going cashless for a lot of people would be quite dangerous. There are people who aren't tech savvy and wouldn't understand how to budget using like Monzo pots or Sterling pots and things like that. And there are also people who just need that visual aspect to be able to save and manage their money. And you take that away from them, and that's how people end up in debt. They're not able to manage their spending because the ability just to pay by card is so free. And it just really limits those people who need to be able to budget and need to be able to follow a plan and a method like using cash to be able to stay in control of their finances.
Yeah, for sure. I want to switch a little bit away from yourself and a bit more towards your community, because you've now built an incredible community of cash stuffers, like an army, right?
Yeah.
You're probably rejuvenating the British economy when it comes to getting cash back in circulation. Like, until 18 months ago, they were like, oh, we can almost phase cash out. Now all of a sudden they're like,
boom.
What's the reason why everyone all of a sudden has cash again? So, like, obviously, there's a big following. You've got a lot of people interested in what you do. What's been, like, some of the response, both positive and negative, that you've received? Because that's the price we have to pay by putting ourselves on the internet,
it
right?
It definitely is. And I think it's a 50-50 mix. There are so many people who get in touch every day to say, I'm in this situation, I'm really struggling, how can I budget, how can I manage my money? And I provide the method of cash stuffing, but also the alternative of how you might do that digitally for them. And I love hearing from people who say, I've started following this method and in 2 months I've managed to pay off this debt, or I've managed to book a family holiday that I paid for in advance. And seeing people set up their own accounts to cash stuff and watching their journeys and just seeing the incredible difference it makes for them. But then we do also have people who don't quite understand the method. The question around safety comes up a lot, the idea that you are missing out on interest, and just the idea that you could just be doing all this in a bank. But it is so individual to everyone's needs. It's about how you learn best. I'm a visual learner, so therefore it works for me. If my followers are visual learners and it works for them, it just gives them some stability and some financial security. And as long as you are managing your money in a way that works for you, I'm not sure it matters which way you choose to do that.
Yeah, you win some, you lose some.
You do.
Right, there's always going to be some trolls. There's always going to be some haters that are like, oh, this is the most stupid thing I've ever seen.
We don't mind.
As you look at them, you go, well, was it more stupid than living paycheck to paycheck 18 months ago? It's literally whatever works for each individual person. So I suppose some people just need to understand that, like, your content isn't for them.
No.
That's not what you're generating in the first
place. And I have to remember myself that if it impacts one person and makes them look at their finances and changes their life, it's so much more important than worrying about 10 other people who are saying, this is ridiculous.
For sure. I love asking people this that have created these money personalities on the internet. And this is something that I often probably should be asking myself, but us as British people, we do not talk about money.
We don't.
It is a taboo.
It is.
With our friends, with our family, let alone with strangers on the internet via optional posting of videos, which is a bit of a crazy thing. I mean, I understand why you kind of came across it and started to do it yourself, but why go public in the first place and why did you think that was so important?
I think sometimes it's easier to tell a stranger about any money issues you have. They don't know you, they don't know your situation, and being accountable. So posting TikTok videos at the very beginning was more about being accountable for my finances, and I never thought it would grow to what it is. But I think we don't talk about money, we don't talk about debt. And we need to normalize that people are trying to pay their debt off. People are trying to be more savvy with their spending. And I think it's really important to see that, to see other people who've had success in a method of budgeting, to see if they can do it, then I can do that too. If my income is similar to theirs and they're able to save this amount, then I can do that. And it just opens up that conversation. It opens up talking about, it's normal to spend this amount on your food shop. It's normal to save this amount. It's normal to be working to pay off some debt of some sort.
Yeah, I mean, I love that. The whole idea for me is this transparency of people just don't know what's the right option. Yeah. So even if, let's say, you're not doing it exactly right for someone else, at least they get that little bit of intel from you. Yeah. They can see how much it's costing you. Yeah. They can judge it for themselves. I mean, the classic response that I'm assuming you get is when you say you spent X amount on a certain category, someone goes, how can you spend that much on food? Or how can you... And you're like, relax, firstly. This is me, personal finance. There's the word personal in there for a reason in the first place. So like, obviously everyone has their own categories. What is kind of your golden piece of financial advice? If I had to ask you kind of like one last question, I love asking this because everyone comes from different perspectives. So from yours, let's say a younger version of you, what's your one tip to them?
Have a budget. Write a budget out. I can't believe that I got to the age of 35 without ever writing a budget. And knowing that it's okay to change that budget, to review it and think something might need changing. You do not have to stick strictly to it. If you suddenly find the next month that something didn't work for you, didn't put enough money away for your food shop, change it. But having that budget written out just keeps you accountable. It helps you track it. You know where your money is going. And you're not going to be confused if a bill goes out that you weren't expecting because it was written and it's there for you to follow.
Absolutely spot on. I would try and add to that, but there's nothing left to add. So anyway, Beth, thank you so much for coming down to the studio. It's been really, really cool to hear. And I mean, should I give it a go? Do you think I should?
I think you should.
Cash stuffing? I'm going to go straight to the ATM. I'm not going to announce publicly on radio which ATM I'm going to go to.
As long as you post the video so I can follow along.
There we go. And I'll tag, well, I'll tag your, I was going to say, like, what hashtag should I use? Forget hashtags. We're not in that generation anymore. I'll try, I might give it a go. This
you
sounds kind of fun.
I'd like to follow that journey.
I'll buy a safe first, right?
Yes. Not just a folder with a padlock.
Not just a folder with a padlock, which I don't even think exists. That sounds like a private diary. Beth, thank you so much for joining us in the studio today. Amazing. So that was Beth from Budgets with Beth. Please give her a follow on social media to find out all things cash stuffing, but budgeting in general. I can clearly tell that if you go and look at some of those videos, you're going to understand the importance of budgeting. I said there's nothing to add. I'm not going to add anything else to it specifically right now. Budgeting, a vital aspect of your personal finances. Scam of the week. Anyone recognize what that is? If you've never heard it before, Scam of the Week is where I do not scam you every single week, but instead I alert you to a scam that's going on to make sure that you can avoid it. So at the moment, there is a scam going around, especially within the summer, of false kind of support when it comes to buying tickets or traveling or all that kind of stuff. So let's say you tweet EasyJet online and you're on Twitter and you say, hey, my flight was delayed, I want compensation, and account that says at Fly EasyJet replied to you saying, oh, we are the customer service team. Please always be suspicious if it's not like the official account reaching out to you, and especially if it's an account that has like zero followers and is starting to ask you really personal or interesting details. These are obvious scam alerts, but they're becoming more prevalent, and they're becoming more prevalent because more people are falling for them, so they get more support. So do keep your eyes out for that kind of scam. Now, one thing in particular that I want to make you aware of so that you don't go around tweeting and messaging airlines without really understanding the core thing is flight delays. Now, in a lot of situations with flight delays, you are due compensation of a certain amount. It's not like a discussion. It's not like, hey, I was delayed. Oh, here's an £100 voucher. No, there are specific amounts that they owe you depending on where you're flying and how far you're flying and how long you were delayed for. So I'm going to refer you to something very technical here. It's called EU261. Now, this is the rule of right and regulation that applies to flight delays and how much you're going to get. So I'm going to explain to you briefly. I've got a table in front of me. If you are delayed over 3 hours and you're flying somewhere out of EU, I think the UK still falls under this law. I'm fairly certain, in fact, you will be owed somewhere between 250 and 600 euros. How do I know that this is actually true and it's a thing? Well, 5 years ago, I was flying from the UK to Costa Rica. I was delayed by about 6 hours and I had 600 euros sent to me because of this rule. Literally, they couldn't argue. There was no debate. They had to send it. So give EU261 a Google. There are already pre-filled out specific kind of like formats of how to write the letter. You just have to factually share your ticket, you know, your exact delay, the exact flight you were on, where you were going from, where you were going to. Make sure that it kind of falls in line with the exact amount in terms of the distance of the journey and how long you were delayed for. There are tables online. Just Google EU261 table. And that airline will have to send you money. That's going to come very relevant because I assume most of us do are traveling in the summer. So yeah, go check that out. It's a really important one. And you can even check it out on TikTok because I made loads of videos about the topic as well, and so have many other people. Now, it is time for me to answer some of the questions that you guys have been sending in. So I'll quickly shout out to the live stream. If you are watching it, please do ask your questions now. I will answer them live on air. So if you've ever wanted a finance or a money-based question to be answered live on radio, this is your chance. But if you want to kind of get involved in the coming weeks, you can just DM us at That Money Show on social media, ping us a question in the DMs, and we will respond to them every single week. We've had a few questions coming in from last week that I will answer. But if one does come in live right now, I will try and answer that one as well. Anything to do with money, anything that you want at all. So Willow has asked me, do I have a financial regret? The follow-up question is, if so, what is it? Because I could just say yes and then move on swiftly to the next question. Do I have a financial regret? Ola's one was really good about not investing earlier. But I think my general financial regret was not being interested in it from a younger age. It just seemed like such a boring subject, money. And it still might to you. Fair enough. I completely understand it. But what you don't realize is just how vital it is. Like, whether you like it or not, whether you're interested or motivated by money, you do have to interact with it throughout your life. You're going to earn it. You're going to spend it, right? So all I would kind of say as a big financial regret or something kind of like a lesson is that go listen to a podcast, watch a YouTube video, read a book, pick one, spark your interest in the topic and find the area that does interest you. There's actually not that much to learn. After a while, you'll see the same kind of core messages coming up. So if you're not devoutly like interested in the subject of finance, you can probably cover it pretty quickly. But if you're, let's say, 16 right now, or somewhere between the ages of 16 and 25, you're right at the beginning of your financial journey. Just go and do something with your education. Do a little bit here, 10 minutes one week, 10 minutes the next week, even more if you have the patience for it. And that will transform your life. My regret is, quite literally, I didn't start earlier learning about money. Question in from the live stream. Someone who is 16, great, go learn about money. Is there any way that they can start investing? There is a way you can start actually investing when you are 16 years old. It's called a junior ISA. So a junior ISA is a junior individual saving account, to kind of spell it out. And that is an account that your parents or guardians will have to help you open. And within that, you can invest into stocks and shares on many different websites. So you can just go online and type in where is the best place to open a junior ISA or best junior ISA platforms. Do this with your parents if you're 16 years old. And with their support, you can start investing and managing your money. So from 16, you can actually start managing money that goes into that account, and 18 you can actually withdraw it and that becomes your money. If you are investing, please, from 16 to 18, that is a really short time span. We're looking from 16 to 76, please, 50 years or 60 years of time span. That is much better. But yes is the answer. Yes, you can. Another question that's come in from online, I just kind of saw it earlier. Oh, it's not a question. Someone just said, I put 80% of my income to savings and the rest 20% to my personal use. Felicia, that's a double thumbs up. That's not a question, but it's absolutely brilliant that you're saving 80% of your income. I don't know how you're doing that. If you would like to share those tips, please do. I will get you on the show itself. The next question, Greg. So Greg DM'd us and he asked, or he said, I've just received the promotion, but it means my salary will just put me into a 40% tax bracket. What should I do? Can I ask my boss to negotiate my salary so I'm just under it? Classic misconception is that when you go into a new tax bracket, your entire salary isn't taxed at that amount. In other words, you've gone from earning $50,000 being taxed at 20% to earning $51,000 being taxed at 40%. No, you are not taking home less money. This is really important to say. Just whatever you are earning over the threshold, which is £50,270, will be taxed at that 40%. So in your case, if you're earning $51,000, quick maths, £730 taxed at 40%, the rest taxed completely normally. Don't ask for a lower salary. The only time where your take-home pay will be reduced by an increase or by a raise is when it's related to kind of child benefits. So you'll firstly, you should be aware of the various child benefits, but B, you can get around that by just contributing towards your pension to bring your salary back below a threshold to make sure that you can get those child benefits. So that's something else as well. You shouldn't really be turning down raises. Probably not the best look when your boss goes, why are they turning down a raise? Do they really know how money works? Especially if you work in finance. Not a great idea. And the last question, Roman has asked, I want to go self-employed. What are the main things I need to know? Being self-employed, you're going to have to do your own tax returns every single year. So make sure you get a good accountant or you're fully aware of all the tax returns you have to do. That's kind of the key thing. The other thing I would say is probably build an emergency fund. If you are going self-employed, there is that risk that you might not earn money 1 month because you're not getting your salary every single month. So my main kind of piece of advice is build a big pot of money somewhere in the region of 6 to 12 months worth of living expenses to really allow yourself to have a good go at that self-employed life. That way, if you don't owe money 1 month, you're good. You've got that kind of backing. You've got that emergency fund that you can dip into. But hopefully you won't have to, but it's a great psychological safety net. Anyway, that brings us to the end of this week's show. I know, it feels like it's gone really quickly. But I hope you have learned something with your money. I just quickly want to thank everyone that came in today. We had Amy from NerdWallet. We had Ola from All Things Money. And we had Beth from Budgets with Beth. So they were all brilliant guests. I hope you learned something amazing from all of them. And if you want to find out more, you can find us at That Money Show on social media. You can listen back to us on all good podcasting platforms. You can download the FUBAR app to listen to us live every single week. I've been That Money Guy. This has been That Money Show, and I'll see you next week.